From BYU International Cinema, this is From the Booth. I'm Marie-Laure Oskarsson, IC Assistant Director, and this podcast is a recording of the conversation between two BYU professors from the College of Humanities, Chip Oskarsson and George Handley. They both received their PhDs from the University of California in Berkeley, and they teach classes in the Department of Comparative Arts and Letters. They're passionate about our planet and environmental humanities. In this podcast, they talk with admiration about Terrence Malick's film, The Tree of Life. The Tree of Life is playing at IC this week. Don't miss it. This film explores themes such as faith, the meaning of life, joy, suffering, and healing, trust in God, human connections, communion with nature. George and Chip talk about the healing power of faith. They invite us to watch this film as we would listen to a serious sermon. They are asking us to experience it as poetry. Thanks to Chip and George for sharing their love and awe of God and the beauty that permeate their conversation. Before you listen to their inspiring exchange, I would like to thank the College of Humanities for their support of international cinema. The original music for our podcast is by Johnny, Stephen, and Greg Stallings. To all, a warm thank you. Work on the sound is by Hayden Underwood. Hayden is graduating this month, and we wish him all the best in his next adventures. Thank you, Hayden, for all your great and creative work, not only on the podcast, but also on the weekly IC trailers, posters, and everything image at IC. We will miss you. Another warm thank you to IC projectionist Anna Evans, who will do her student teaching in art next semester. We wish her the best teaching experience and the best students. Thank you, Anna, for years of great work at IC. We will miss you so much. And now, on to the conversation with George and Chip. Welcome both to From the Booth.
All right, it's good to be here with you, George, talking about Tree of Life, a film that both of us like quite a bit.
Thanks, Chip. It's good to be with you.
George, you have had a chance to think about this film, quite a bit, but it's a film that's that can also be challenging. What is it that first drew you to this film? Like, what was it that sparked interest either in, you know, the beauty of the film or the ideas of the film? What drew you in?
That's a great question. I think it was precisely because it was so different than other films. The voiceovers really compelled me. The music really compelled me, and the beauty of the cinematography and the way in which it was a little bit jumbled in chronological order. All those factors kind of make you sit up and pay more attention, I think. At least that's what I would recommend, rather than just sort of reacting to it as this is not how movies normally go, so I don't understand what's going on. I think if you kind of let the logic of the film kind of wash over you a little bit, it definitely warrants more than one watching, you know, for that reason. Yeah. But obviously that's not always possible. But I think the spiritual themes ultimately were the ones that compelled me the most. Maybe it's because I grew up in a family of three brothers and I did lose one of them, tragically. So I guess like that kind of story, you know, certainly compelled me and my surviving brother who watched it at the same time that I did. And we were both just completely knocked out by it. And you know, it was the kind of movie, as you and I we've been talking about it for many years. It's the kind of movie you just keep wanting to talk about with people.
Yeah. I think maybe something that helps me in thinking about films like this is thinking about the distinction between prose and poetry, right? That sometimes films that we watch, we have this expectation that the narrative is the thing, right? In a lot of ways. And the, you know, having a really strong kind of narrative where there's a, you know, kind of beginning, middle, and end is part of the pleasure of, you know, of watching the film. And there's a lot that comes with that. But in this case, this film is more poetry than prose insofar that it doesn't explain everything, right? That there's a lot of gaps. And maybe, you know, when you say that it's one of these films that we keep coming back to and can keep thinking about and keep discussing, it's kind of like poetry in that respect, in that there's kind of intentional openness that invites us in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
But we have to temper our expectations, right? That it's, we have to, in the same way that we read a poem differently than we read a novel, or that we read instructions, you know, to putting together IKEA furniture or something like that.
Yeah.
It's, we should expect there to be gaps.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. I mean, it's also more like ballet and opera in some ways, mm-hmm. than traditional film, because there are those long sequences without any dialogue at all, where there's just body movement, and it's beautiful and it's graceful, and there's gorgeous music, and so it felt almost like dance at times, or like opera. But I think the voiceovers, I was recently reading in Marilynne Robinson's novel Gilead, and I wish I had remembered to bring the quote, but she says something in there that kind of sounds to me like what Malick was up to. She says, she's talking about a voice that isn't narrative, and it's not vocalized, but it is sort of the voice of consciousness, or mm-hmm. a kind of voice of the spirit that is a dialogue that's going on inside of us. And that's, I think, a really helpful way to think about these whispered phrases in the movie that sometimes are connected to a narrative event and other times are just connected to an object of reflection, but they are nevertheless a kind of deeper level of consciousness that maybe even these characters sometimes aren't fully conscious of, right? But these are the questions that are really driving them. Like the mother, clearly, even though she comes to some resolution about the loss of her son, you know, whether she ever vocalized her complaint to God or not, she did say, you know, we hear her saying, "Where were you?" To the Lord, in her kind of most painful moment. So those are the boy, of course, watching the other boy drown, and then kind of comes to this conclusion. Again, they're almost like prayers, really, spiritual questions. You would let anything happen, mm-hmm. he says, you know, to God. Like, if you would let that happen, it seems like everything's on the table. Like, there's nothing you wouldn't let happen.
Yeah. I think it's significant, and this is a great insight that you're pointing to, that it's always in the voice of the characters, right? So that if we think in terms of diegetic, non-diegetic sound, you know, sometimes a voiceover is used as it's that authoritative voice from outside that's going to fix meaning
for
us.
Yeah, but it's the opposite.
It's the opposite. It's kind of within here, and that it's deeply interior, actually.
Yeah.
And that it helps to align the images that we're seeing, that, you know, he tends to use, you know, very short cuts, a very fluid camera. It's always a kind of montage, approach, where it's about building an idea through these multiple images. And it functions almost kind of like memory in that way, in that so many of our memories are these kind of amalgamations of images and experiences that create a kind of a sense of feeling that at times can be hard to articulate in words. And here that meaning, I think, exists, you know, between these voiceovers and the images that we're seeing constantly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's well said. Yeah. Sometimes like with the father, I'm thinking what you were just saying made me think of the line the father says towards the end, which I think is a really pivotal moment in the movie, where he says, I wanted to be loved because I was great. Mm-hmm. A big man, I'm nothing. Look at the glory around us. I mean, that I'm a foolish man. That's like in so many words, in very few words, a summary of a complete pivot in his life, right? That first phrase, I wanted to be loved because I was great, is a confession. But it's a statement that even if he never narrated that to himself, certainly when he was under the influence of that idea, he probably didn't know it, mm-hmm. right? It's only as he comes out of that narrative that he'd been telling himself that I need to be great so that I can be loved. And when he finally breaks from the spell of that, he realizes I'm foolish, right? Which is, of course, the sort of fundamental Christian turn to, you know, acknowledge that we're fools, and he is now accepting of his vulnerability, accepting of the vulnerability of life. And, you know, anyway, we can talk more about that.
Yeah.
But I think that that's sometimes there are sentences that we might never actually come out and verbalize that are driving the way we're reacting to the world and to life, you know, and becoming more conscious of those, which this film sort of forces us to do, I think is really healthy.
Well, and it's interesting to think about, you know, the technique that's used, that, you know, how do you get, I mean, I don't know if it's exactly kind of the subconscious, you know, that, you know, but it's like you're saying, it's something that's something that the characters have a hard time even articulating to themselves. How does a film get at that, right? How does a film portray, you know, something like that? And I think it's really interesting how Malick approaches it.
Yeah.
But let's pursue this idea. At the beginning of the film, we hear in the mother's voice this quote. She says, "The nuns taught us there are two ways through life, the way of nature and the way of grace. You have to choose which one you'll follow. Grace doesn't try to please itself, accepts being slighted, forgotten, disliked, accepts insults and injuries. Nature only wants to please itself, get others to please it too, likes to lord it over them, to have its own way. It finds reasons to be unhappy when all the world is shining around it, when love is smiling through all things. They taught us that no one who loves the way of grace ever comes to a bad end. It'll be true of you," speaking to her son.
Yeah.
Now, that was a condensation of many, many minutes,
yeah.
right? It's
yeah.
not that right. Concise in,
so
the,
beautiful.
In the film.
Yeah.
But talk to me a little bit about how you understand this distinction between the way of grace and the way of nature as it's articulated here.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's a Catholic way of describing something that I think we find in other Christian traditions and in our own, in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You know, the way of nature might be comparable to what we in our tradition call the natural man, right? It's sort of the instinct of self-preservation, the instinct of protection, and acquisition of things that we need to continue to secure our safety and validity and legitimacy in the world, all without God, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, I can do this on my own. I don't need anyone else. And it's really a position of profound fear, right? Which is what the father ultimately comes to realize much later than his own wife understood, that he needed to accept the way of grace. The way of grace is a way of vulnerability, right? It's
mm-hmm.
it's not about self-protection or self-aggrandizement or and it's willing to accept injury. I mean, we think of that also in our tradition as the pure love of Christ, or what Paul in 1 Corinthians 13 describes as charity, right?
Mm-hmm.
This capacity to suffer all things, believe all things, endure all things, and not be offended, which, of course, in, you know, Buddhism is also a kind of way of understanding ourselves as connected to all things.
Yeah.
And that means there's a certain degree of suffering that has to come by virtue of being so interconnected. But there is a grace or a healing power available to us when we lean into that and stop fighting it. And
mm-hmm.
and that's, you know, his transition. And I know you know this story, but when I was I happened to be rereading Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky when I was watching this film and teaching it, I think for one of the first times. And look at the glory around us. This is the father continuing. He says, I wanted to be loved because I was great. A big man, I'm nothing. Look at the glory around us, trees and birds. I live in shame. I dishonored it all and didn't notice the glory. You know, the film is a great tribute to the mother for her capacity to see the glory of
mm-hmm.
the creation and the glory of existence, even though, or even precisely because of what she has suffered. And the father doesn't come to that understanding until the very end. that line is adapted from the novel by Dostoevsky, in which, I mean, I won't go into the details, but basically Dostoevsky's own sort of Christian existentialism was that, you know, one day one of his characters says is enough to know all happiness. Like it doesn't matter what happens or doesn't happen to you. It doesn't matter what you have or don't have. The fact that you are alive and that you it means you are in God's grace. It means you are in God's breath and his love. And you, if you will allow that reality to if you'll accept it in your heart and you'll stop wanting things to be different than they are, or stop needing people to do things or to get things, then you will learn that way of wisdom, and you will, but it will mean you'll have to suffer, right? Yeah. It will mean that you, and that's the great nobility of the mother, right? Because she has suffered the greatest injury, right? Losing her son, so tragically and suddenly, and then having essentially to give him back to God, right? Which is what it means to accept something like that.
Yeah. So help bring together for us the different parts of this film then, because while on the one hand we have this, this, you know, very kind of loose fragmented story about this family, three brothers, you know, one of the brothers dies. It's in some kind of tragic instance. We don't know all the details of it. This causes great suffering for the family. It's suffering that lingers. It seems to linger. We get kind of images of this family at different points in time, and it's kind of all jumbled up, right? Mm-hmm. We have the one of the other sons that we seem to be focalizing through to a certain degree. As an adult, we have him as a child, right? That, yeah. You know, we kind of go through this. And interspersed with all of this is this... this intense focus on the natural world, right? What is it that Malick is trying to do with the, you know, the focus on the tree of life, right? There's a tree he kind of keeps coming back to. Maybe that's the tree he's referring to. I don't know, right? But beyond that, we have this incredible creation sequence, right, where we see the creation and you know, kind of and growth and evolution of the world. In this really fantastic way, we get all of these other really spectacular, you know, images that we're invited to dwell with, right? They're not just kind of static tableaus, but the camera moves us around in these places, and they we get a sense of their embodiment, you know, in some really interesting ways. You maybe started to get at this a little bit in your description of the mother, right, in her willingness to see the glory. The vulnerability that's required to do that begins to point us towards an interconnectedness, right? That there's already kind of an ecological, you know, dimension, you know, to that. But what's the connection, right?
Yeah.
And maybe we need to look at Job here a little bit, because Job, you know, the book of Job is structured actually in a very similar kind of way.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is the connection is in that story of the book of Job, which is quoted in the film, right? Where God says, you know, where he's speaking to Job, and he's like, mm-hmm. where were you at the foundations of the world? And then he goes on and says, what do you know about, you know, the whales in the ocean? What do you know about glaciers? What do you know about wild animals and how they mate and how they feed themselves? And I'm, you know, this is my work, and my glory is not only you, but it's also all of this creation. I'm working on, I provide the rain, I provide the snow, and these are my creatures, and I love them. And you know,
does Job find that a satisfying answer right away?
Well, yeah, it's very alienating, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the nature of suffering is very self-centering, right? I mean, it's by nature a you know, I mean, I lost an older brother to a suicide when I was 18 years old. And I remember feeling angry that the world was moving. You know, it's just like, why is anybody doing anything? And why is anybody smiling? Why is anybody driving a car to the grocery store or doing anything? Like, everything should stop, which, of course, is, yeah, it's understandable, but it's a very self-centered way of seeing the world. And suffering is by nature self-centering, but it you know, to move through it, right? You have to get past that mm-hmm. and you have to start realizing compassion again. You have to start looking at the world and also appreciating beauty, right? And I think Job is maybe at first sort of disturbed by the lecture he's getting, which is a botany and geology and biology lecture from God, the longest in scripture by yeah. God the Father, by the way. So it's not to be taken lightly. It's a pretty serious text. And he is, I think he's healed by virtue of being decentered, right? Yeah. He's no longer, his story is no longer the only one. And God's compassion and love is available to him, but it's also available to everything else.
Yeah.
And when he can let go of his story and his losses being the only thing that matters, he's able to move into healing. And that's certainly, you know, and there's also, by the way, an overlay of Abraham here, because I think the mother, another crucial line in the film is when she says, "I give you my son, I give him to you." You know, it echoes very quickly with what Abraham, mm-hmm. Abraham's asked to sacrifice his son. And you say, well, that's an exceptional story. And what that suddenly causes us to realize is that God actually asks us to sacrifice when we accept death, right? We are giving, and she is giving her son back to God. It's not that she wills him to die, but right. She willfully accepts what has happened, yeah. right? And that's the level of acceptance that's required for true healing, is to be almost Abrahamic, right, in your yeah. courage. And I think that's a really beautiful, but the key that your question is getting at is that she always understood the grace and beauty of the natural world. She always accepted it as this existential gift. And by existential, I mean it didn't depend on anything she did or didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the beauty of the world was always available if we just had the eyes to see it. And the father can't see it until the end, right? When he's finally able to let go of his own ego. So I think actually, again, there's this tremendous healing that's available to us when we decenter ourselves and look at the glory of the creation and let go of our own narratives about ourselves. It doesn't mean that the things that happen to us don't matter. In fact, I think being broken by the things that happen to us is what makes us open
yeah.
to the creation, right? Mm-hmm. And that the creation ends up taking on this very powerful healing quality to it. And this is a deeply Christian film, and Malick's a Catholic. Malick lost an older brother, a younger brother, to suicide. So there is an autobiographical overlay of the film. I don't think we have to only see it that way, but clearly that's what he's drawing on. And I think he sees the Christian story as inherently arguing that all of creation is a manifestation and an expression of God's love.
Yeah.
And that does mean some ugliness has to be a part of that.
That's what I wanted to follow up on, right? That there's some tough theology in here, because when we're talking about the beauty of creation, we're actually not just talking about beautiful things, right? And that Malick's nature, or better said, Malick, to get our term straight, he's using this idea of the way of nature. So let's talk about creation. Creation for Malick is not pastoral. It is not harmonious always. It is not, it is not necessarily the walk in the mountains that connects us, with nature. It's also the ugly parts of it, right?
Yeah.
It's the violent parts. It's the horrible parts. That we have to, as you were alluding to earlier, accept the death of a child, as much as the gift of a child, right? Talk to me a little bit about how you understand Malick's view of creation and how that view of creation is a manifestation of God's love, even in its horrible aspects.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, one of the central theological, kind of questions that we grapple with, right? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why does a loving God allow hard things to happen?
Yeah, that's such an important question. I mean, there's a lot to think about, but I guess maybe one thing to remember, first of all, is, you know, one of the realizations Job comes to is the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. And then he expresses his love and devotion to God. And if God is a giver of gifts, any gift that we get is not ours to keep, right? Mm-hmm. That's the definition of a gift, really. It's like, it's on loan, it's given, it's something to appreciate and be grateful for, but it will go, or mm-hmm. we have to be prepared for the fact that it's, so the gift of life is also accompanied by death, right? Yeah. And so the creation is always asking us to wrestle with, and the gift of joy means that there's a gift of sorrow, the gift of restoration is accompanied with a gift of theft, or, you know, of, mm-hmm. of something being taken. So I think Malick's just trying to understand that. Now, of course, there are, he doesn't get into the theology explicitly, but there are images toward the end of the film of an imagined heaven, right? Mm-hmm. There's an imagined space where she sees her boy again.
That look a lot like the salt flats in Utah.
Yeah, they do. And it's such a, you know, it's so beautiful,
it is,
right?
Beautiful.
And it's so I think he, yeah. you know, I think he has the Christian hope, as I do, that, you know, there will be a restoration. There will be a chance to see our loved ones again. There will be a chance to be restored to what we lost. But I don't think we're ever, it's not like we go back to what we were before.
Right.
I think there, we can't, there's divine beauty and purpose in that understanding of suffering. Again, I don't think it means that suffering is something that is good on its own, or something that we should wish upon people, or shouldn't try to mitigate or stop when we see suffering happening in others. In fact, I think it calls us to a life of compassion, because that's what God is doing, right? God is in the work of healing us and doing so compassionately. That seems to be the message of the film, and it seems to be central to what it means to be a Christian. So I don't think there's any place in Christian thinking for justifying evil and suffering as yeah. necessary for God's purposes, so we just sort of stand back and let it happen. That seems yeah. absolutely cruel and, mm-hmm. and un-Christian.
Well, and actually is criticized, I think, in the film, right? That there's yeah, the neighbor in her, you know, kind of like Job's friends trying to, yeah. I'm not sure, console or
well.
Justify or what, you know, what she's trying to
she's
do.
Like, he's in a better place.
Yeah.
And then she's like, well, he ain't with me.
You that's know? Like, that's exactly right. But it is yeah. kind of moving towards this, that we see, you know, the mother working towards that, you know, that pivotal point that you mentioned earlier, where she's able to give her son to God, to kind of accept,
just
accept
as kills well. Me every time.
Yeah. yeah.
Because that to me is so extraordinarily heroic, right?
Mm-hmm.
To get to that level of acceptance, she's not holding back anything. She's not
yeah.
begrudging God in any way. And yet, you know, she has suffered every
yeah.
ounce of that loss, but she gracefully gives back what was given to her, and it's an emotional
yeah.
giving back. It's not a physical.
Well,
giving
and
back,
I like how you set up this parallel with, you know, with Abraham, which of course evokes kind of Søren Kierkegaard's, you know, meditations on Abraham, and how that, you know, he views, you know, Abraham's willingness to give his son illogically, you know, to God, the son that, you know, he's been promised this progeny will come through. And I mean, it makes no sense that God is asking him to, you know, to kill him. He's willing to give him to God. It's, you know, she becomes that knight of faith, as
yeah.
you know, Kierkegaard puts it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so in conclusion here, George, what would you recommend for someone who's approaching this film, for the first time? What's your recommendation to kind of get the most out of it?
Well, I think I would, and first of all, we haven't said much about the music. You know, Malick is a great lover of great music, and there's so much great
music.
There's
a lot of great music in this film.
And I think what he's doing with the music and the imagery is just such gorgeous filmmaking that I think you should just let it wash over you. Enjoy it, right?
Yeah.
And enjoy I love what you said, you know, think about the film more as poetry than narrative. But there is a narrative there that you can start to piece together. And I think if you understand how serious he is about trying to think about the cosmos and the nature of the creation itself and how it relates to this small life, I think you're onto something. And you and I have debated a little bit about the very ending of the film, but I think the you know, Sean Penn, who's playing the oldest brother as an adult, and as you indicated, you know, the problems of the loss have continued for many years. I think there's an important, you know, you've got the sunflowers and the bridge and those images of an afterlife. You know, there, I think the film is moving us toward a hopeful resolution to what he is wrestling with. And I think people ought to watch this film as if they were listening to a very serious sermon, because it's one of the most beautiful and moving spiritual movies I've ever seen.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the mother's, the quote that I quoted from the mother earlier, is maybe a good guide for watching the film too. Don't feel like you have to be in control, understanding every little thing, you know, that's being shown to you. It's about being open, right?
Yeah.
To the film and experiencing the film. My recommendation would be, don't just experience it once.
Yeah,
experience it more than once. Absolutely. It'll keep opening up itself.
Yeah. It never gets old.
Never gets old. All right. Well, thank you, George, so much for being here and for discussing this with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's a lot of fun.